Hello, and welcome to another episode of Such Stuff, the podcast from Shakespeare's Globe. This week, we return to our series on Shakespeare and race. Last week, we dedicated an entire episode to the question of whiteness, what it means, and why it's important for us to examine it in relation to Shakespeare. In this episode, we take a closer look at the way that whiteness has dominated how we read Shakespeare, from the first moment we pick up a Shakespeare play. For too long, ways of looking at Shakespeare have been dominated by a concern with whiteness, but one that goes unacknowledged. In the field of Shakespeare studies, this has marginalised the voices, the concerns, and the interests of scholars of colour. If we are reading Shakespeare in narrow ways, do we also teach Shakespeare from these same narrow perspectives, and pass the same narrow concerns on to another generation of Shakespeare readers and scholars? Here's our very own Professor Farah Karim Cooper.
This episode focuses on the whiteness of Shakespeare. For many, it is obvious to say that Shakespeare was white. But the word Shakespeare means many things, not just referring to the man from Stratford. It refers also to his canon of works, to the field of inquiry Shakespeare studies, to the body of his performance history, and to the industry, or more precisely, the cultural phenomena that is Shakespeare. Whiteness permeates all of these various meanings. In the field of critical race studies, whiteness studies is emerging as an important way of coming to grips with systemic racism. To understand that to be white means having a racial identity is to understand the privilege that comes with that racial identity. But most think of whiteness as normal, non-racial, to the point of invisibility. But this is dangerous because it means that everyone else is othered or made strange. When actually, according to Richard Dyer's book, White, whiteness needs to be made strange itself. So we'll be talking to Dr. Ruben Espinoza, Associate Professor of English at the University of Texas, El Paso, who co-edited Shakespeare and Immigration in 2014, which was a collection exploring the role of immigrants, exiles, and refugees in Shakespeare's England. He's currently working on a book called Shakespeare on the Shades of Racism, and he is a member of the Board of Trustees for the Shakespeare Association of America. We'll also be hearing from Dr. Amberine Dadaboy, Assistant Professor of Literature at Harvey Mudd College. Her research focuses on cross-cultural encounters in the early modern Mediterranean and race and religion in early modern English drama. Amberine's work also seeks to bridge the past to the present to illustrate how early modern racial and religious discourses and their prejudices still speak to the present day. Currently, she's working on a project that explores early modern anti-blackness from the Mediterranean to the Atlantic. As we explore questions about Shakespeare's whiteness, from the works to the discipline of Shakespeare studies, we'll also be thinking about how we can even begin to decolonize Shakespeare. So I'm here with Amberine Dadaboy, who is going to talk to us about the whiteness in Shakespeare. So I'm just going to dive right in and ask how you became interested in Shakespeare, and particularly how you became interested in the topic of Shakespeare and race.
So I wish I could say that those are two related questions, and they are a little bit, but the way I became interested in Shakespeare was really through a college class. And I went to Cal State Long Beach, so I went to a large public institution. And this Shakespeare class probably had like 35 students in it. The mode of instruction was lecture, and my professor really was this incredible, dear, older white man who stood at the lectern and pontificated at us. And he just made me fall in love with the words that he was so in love with. It wasn't my first introduction to Shakespeare. Obviously, we have to read Shakespeare in high school in the US curriculum, but really that was the moment where I thought about this as something that could be a career path. I don't have any academics in my family, so I didn't know about what that would look like. And maybe I would have changed my mind if I had known what it would look like. But that was really what solidified it for me. And then thinking about Shakespeare in the context of whiteness in terms of my scholarly journey was really when I was a graduate instructor and I was teaching a course on race, gender, and power in Renaissance drama. And I've talked about the story many times in many contexts. My students in that class were really hesitant to talk about blackness in Othello. Getting them to even get as far as they did, which was to simply restate what the play says about Othello being noble despite his color, felt like it was a lot, but it also felt like a failure. And so coming out of that experience, I decided to explore this further, and that became the topic of my dissertation. I graduated from my PhD in 2008. So things have changed rapidly in how we write about and think about race from that point to this point. So at that point, I was really thinking about others. I wasn't necessarily interrogating whiteness because that wasn't what the critical tradition was. What I was looking for was a kind of presence. I was looking for accuracy. I was looking for all of the wrong things about so-called others because I wasn't looking at how others were being made, regardless of accuracy, to serve a purpose for English audiences, right? To cement for the English what it meant for them to be English and the way that whiteness worked in that process and how that was also in service of kind of building an empire. They certainly didn't have one, but they knew what an empire looked like from Spain, from the Ottomans, from their complex history in Ireland, right? So they were able to conceive what that would look like and what that would look like through the labor of people who could be identified as racially not white.
Well, I think what's really interesting about your journey, it sounds very similar to mine in the sense that as you study Shakespeare, as it's delivered in the critical tradition and also performance tradition, you become invisible to yourself almost as a scholar of color, and you kind of adopt and adapt to this sort of whiteness. And so it becomes a real revelation, doesn't it, when you realize, actually, I want to talk about Shakespeare from a very different perspective. You've written really eloquently about the whiteness of Shakespeare, and I wonder if you could talk a bit more about the way Shakespeare is read, how whiteness manifests and dominates the reading of Shakespeare.
Thinking through all of the experiences that I've had since writing my dissertation, and even when I look back at that project, I can see in that project the way that I have situated myself not as a scholar of color interrogating these issues, but as impersonating the persona of an objective scholar of Shakespeare, right? That is not raced, that is not gendered, that is not situated in a class identity, right? So I assumed a position that is foreign to me. And now when I read those words, I would like to change everything about that project. And so part of the whiteness that arises when we're reading Shakespeare, I think, is in how he has been positioned for us as this kind of universal, right? Shakespeare speaks for all of us. And in having that power to speak for all of us, we never really think about the identity of the speaker. And so Shakespeare has been positioned as a transcendent figure without race, without gender, without politics, without anything. And that's an incredible position to be in, so that you are never questioned for your ideological agendas, because Shakespeare doesn't have any. It's just Shakespeare. But if we actually think about the fact that Shakespeare was a white man, and that whiteness is important to the work that he's writing, then we have to actually take seriously those moments in Shakespeare where race comes up and we sort of gloss it over. So I'm thinking about moments in like Much Ado, where Claudio says he would marry Hero's cousin even if she were an Ethiop. Right? What does that mean? If we've read Kim Hall's Things of Darkness, we know exactly what that means. But if we haven't read it, we're just maybe in the moment of teaching or in the moment of reading, writing it off as a kind of aberration, or this is some sort of old-fashioned language that is not relevant to us, or it doesn't mean what we think it means, right? And that instinctual what we think it means And the writing off of it, I think, is very much the position of reading through whiteness, which is a position of ignoring race until it becomes something that we can't ignore anymore. In Othello, we can't ignore it anymore. And yet I've still seen scholars and I've witnessed productions where people say, we didn't want this play to be about race. In which case I ask, why did you decide to do this one and not Cymbeline if you wanted to talk about violence against women, or not The Winter's Tale if you wanted to talk about jealousy, right? You pick up Othello for a reason. And if you're not going to read race, you have to think about what kind of privilege you have in deciding that you can't see race anymore. And that's the same privilege in deciding that Shakespeare gets to speak for all of us, because his white male position can always be rendered transcendent, whereas my position as a Pakistani Muslim woman, I can only ever speak for myself.
Yes. I think what you were saying about the line from Much Ado about the Ethiop, I was going to add that in performance, that will get cut. Directors in a rehearsal room don't know what to do with that line. And a lot of actors of color I've spoken to have talked about how often their white directors don't know how to cope with that in the room. So it just gets ignored and it gets elided. And of course, that is the privilege that you're referring to. That's a really interesting perspective from, you know, the angle of reading Shakespeare. But I'm wondering if you can talk a bit about how sort of whiteness comes into play when you're teaching.
Yeah, so the Much Ado example, I think, still speaks to this, because before we get to that moment of Claudio saying he would marry her even if she were an Ethiop, during the wedding scene, after Hero's been repudiated, her father says that he wished she would have fallen into a pit of ink, right? And so there's already that blackening happening rhetorically in the text that is then sort of manifested in this phantom Ethiop that recurs at the end of the play. So in fall of 2019, I did a course called Hashtag Me Too Shakespeare. And in that course, we talked about issues of gendered violence, but we also talked about issues of racialized and gendered violence. And while we don't have any women of name characters in Shakespeare who are women of color, we do have a sort of shadow text with all of these references, right? And so I often assign parts of Things of Darkness to my students. And in this Me Too Shakespeare course, we did end up reading a lot of comedies because they are about marriage, and because within those plots of appropriate marriage, there is a lot of rhetorical and real violence enacted against women. And a lot of that also relies on conjuring up an other in order to achieve the final happy marriage at the end. So my students are the ones who actually point out all of these moments, right? And to sort of collect and archive them, and then sort of see how what the whole point of this kind of rhetorical conjuring of the other meant in terms of what the play is trying to expose to us about the desirability of women and the fears of patriarchy. So I really think that we confront whiteness all the time in our teaching, especially as scholars of color, right? Walking into the room, I'm confronting whiteness in a certain way because I don't look like, through my skin, any other scholar of Shakespeare that's on the Claremont College's campuses. So in that way, I'm already different and other. And then the object that I teach is this colossus of English literature who is also white and yet universal. And so I'm confronting that through my reading of Shakespeare, but I think it's important that we highlight for our students that when we are reading these texts or when we're trying to analyze them, there's actual work being done in the text to establish what culture and society are. And a lot of times that is through these others. And so we are getting the formation, not of these others, but a formation of a white culture and a white society and what it means to be English and appropriately English.
I think it's, again, really interesting what you were saying about being a teacher in a classroom full of students who might have a very different expectation about what a Shakespeare professor might look like. You know, if you don't have the elbow patches and the gray beard, then, you know, you have more work to do to convince your students that you have the authority in terms of your knowledge to stand there and talk about this. And that is a real challenge that I think a lot of white scholars don't necessarily appreciate. And as you say, also dealing with this colossus that is Shakespeare. So thinking about this colossus then, how do we move forward to read Shakespeare through the lens of anti-racism? And I suppose attached to that question is the question that we're asking all of our podcast participants, which is, how do we decolonize Shakespeare? What does that mean to you?
Those are fantastic questions. I think that for the first one, to be anti-racist, the first step is that we acknowledge that race exists in the period, that some of his texts not just have racial thinking, but they are in fact racist. So there is such a barrier to even approaching these texts in this way in our field in general. You can't even have an inclusive classroom if you're not willing to accept that race exists in this period and not hide behind history or anachronism or all of these other things. So that for me is the first step in thinking through what it means to be anti-racist. And to answer the second question at the same time, I don't know if we can decolonize Shakespeare, because Shakespeare is at the center of a colonizing curriculum, right? If we think about the point of education in India for the British Empire and to turn these natives into civilized subjects, and the fact that we use Shakespeare, or Shakespeare was used, I'm not the we in here, right? The fact that these people used Shakespeare to do that, then it already is implicated in colonial and imperial methodologies and violences. I don't think we can decolonize Shakespeare. I think we can, again, be attentive to the imperial histories of Shakespeare. And to be attentive in that way means that we recognize how Shakespeare has been used and how these texts are malleable in this way, and maybe use the logics of these own texts to challenge those relations of power and domination. Those efforts come through, again, having a professoriate that is not all white. It comes through performance tradition that is attentive to race and color conscious, and really bringing through our histories as people who might have suffered under empire in how we interact with Shakespeare. So I taught a global Shakespeare course a couple years ago, and we read three plays, Hamlet, The Tempest, and Othello, and we read two adaptations of each play from different traditions. And for The Tempest, we read Gugiwa Tiongo's A Grain of Wheat, which is so tangentially related to the plot of The Tempest. Like, The Tempest comes up in the narrative, but it is really about Africa or Kenya in the last days of British rule. And that's what The Tempest is about too, right? The island in the last hours of Prospero's rule. But really thinking about not Shakespeare at the center, but this other narrative, which is a narrative of colonial violence, recovery and recuperation, and how we can marginalize Shakespeare to tell that other story.
Ambreen, thank you so much for taking part in our podcast today. It's so great to welcome you back, because I remember you were one of our speakers in the first Shakespeare and Race Festival that we held in 2018. So welcome back, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Farah. I really appreciated it.
We asked four emerging scholars, all doing their PhDs, about their experiences. What's it like to be a scholar of colour in the field of Shakespeare studies?
Hi, my name is Shani. I am a PhD student in the English department at UCL, and I work on Shakespeare and optics.
My name is Hassanah Musa.
Wendy Lennon. Hi, I'm Noor El-Ghazaz. I'm a PhD student at Royal Holloway, University of London, and I study critical race theory and material culture in early modern drama.
How is Shakespeare read through a lens of whiteness? We are given the impression that whiteness is both everything, powerful, beautiful, central, and at the same time its under-examined presence makes it nothing, invisible. Kim Hall's Beauty and the Beast of Whiteness notes that we are taught not to see the issues of white privilege and power. Through this lens, there is also a very subtle but looming sense that Shakespeare, in text and in performance, only belongs to certain people. A sense of ownership that results in the marginalisation of scholars of colour and race studies as if it's a subdiscipline.
To me, the lens of whiteness in Shakespeare is a policing system that ensures the quote-unquote purity of Shakespeare by a demographic of white middle-class gatekeepers. These include practitioners, directors, publishers, teachers, scholars and theatre-goers, as though the ownership of Shakespeare is determined by white skin and its corresponding culture, ideologies and norms. To me, the lens of whiteness is a policing system that soothes the white fear of a black uprising, a black usurping of Shakespeare, a great English icon. Finally, to me, the lens of whiteness is a policing system with at least three subdivisions: white authority, white privilege, and white supremacy. It's important to draw distinctions between the three, as white people are not a homogenous group. Not all white people are the same, a courtesy that is not often extended to their black and brown counterparts. However, all three subdivisions, and there may be even more, must be interrogated in order to start dismantling this lens of whiteness.
So I've been thinking a little bit about the wording of this question, and I kind of want to break it down into two points. The first being, I'm not sure you can really read Shakespeare through the lens of whiteness, because lens implies a focus, to be focusing in or homing in on something, whereas whiteness, it permeates throughout society in a way that it's not really the focal point or a lens through which we see the world. It is the world, if that makes sense. Which brings me to the second point about the question, which is, how is Shakespeare read through the lens of whiteness, where whiteness itself is invisible? So where lens implies focus, whiteness implies a lack of colour. The task then becomes, how do we make whiteness visible? How do we sort of start to see it as a colour that's actually not seen as a colour? So when we read Shakespeare, we don't tend to read Shakespeare through the lens of whiteness. We might read it through the lens of gender, or when we say read it through the lens of race, it's normally through blackness or minority ethnic groups. Shakespeare is essentially the old white guy. So we read Shakespeare as white. I wouldn't say through the lens of whiteness. Shakespeare is loaded with connotations of whiteness, patriarchy, hegemonic, normative white backdrop. That's what it's set against. Without perhaps meaning to, it marginalises and excludes ethnic minority groups, because Shakespeare is heavily loaded with whiteness. You cannot escape it.
Can you give us an example of a time in your career when the white lens through which we read Shakespeare was made explicit, e.g. by colleagues or conversations around you? This question is a challenging one, if I'm honest, because there are so many moments of this happening to me and around me by white scholars in the academy, some of who I still interact with today. So I won't give any specific examples. I do, however, want to address the consequences of what happens when this white lens of Shakespeare studies polices students of colour. PhD students in general have relatively little authority in the field in comparison to more seasoned professors, for example. Students of colour have the added burden of needing to ingratiate ourselves and our work, whether it's race research or not, to our white counterparts. We have to tone down our blackness, we have to tone down our brownness so that we are palatable to our white colleagues, superiors, cohort, even students if we're lucky enough to take on some teaching during our PhD research. We have to be palatable because our work is consumed by the white academy. And if our work is not sweet enough, the academy spits us back out. When the white lens is made explicitly clear, especially in all white spaces, it takes all my might to suppress a primal scream at how much I have to perform a half version of myself and a diluted version of my race work.
The very obvious one for me as an Asian Indian descent academic in Shakespeare, I would go to conferences at the start of my PhD and there would be an assumption made that I was working on Indian Shakespeare, to the point that some people wouldn't ask me what I was working on. They would just begin talking about it under the assumption that I was working on it because I'm Indian, right? So I think this white lens through which we read Shakespeare became really obvious to me, in the sense that if you're a person of colour, a scholar of colour working in Shakespeare, the assumption there is you must be adding value to scholarly research because of your race. So you cannot really escape your race, because it's so much implied in people's approach to you, the assumptions people make. I feel that slightly robs you of your identity. And I think that's a kind of dangerous, for many reasons, particularly for early research career and PhD students, because it then makes you think, well, should I be working on that? And is it my sort of duty? Is it my duty to be working on that? What it does when somebody comes to you and puts you in that box to educate them about Indian Shakespeare because you are Indian, what that does is cause a lot of diversion of energies. It's really exhausting and perhaps not necessarily something I need to be entertaining. The other way of thinking about this is when people say to me, but I don't see you as Indian, or I don't see you as a person of colour, I don't see colour. And this is very the UK approach of colour blindness. And I do think colour blindness is a form of racism, which is effectively erases your experience of being a person of colour. And, you know, I think I've made some people feel quite uncomfortable if I mention that I'm a person of colour, or that I'm a first generation immigrant, or when I moved here I did speak a word of English. And there's a sort of uncomfortability and a hypersensitivity. They would rather retort back with, I don't see colour, I just see you as everybody else. And you know, the kind of offhanded, Shani, you're playing the race card, which is almost a hypersensitivity to the conversation about these things. Or I get sort of, if it's not hypersensitivity or a refusal to understand, there's a lot of sort of gaslighting. So if I was to point out issues of reading Shakespeare through the white lens, I'd sort of been labelled, and I've seen this happen to other colleagues, not necessarily myself, as being labelled as obsessed with race, as being too aggressive, or gaslighted for being too crazy to make certain assumptions. Assumptions are made, microaggressions are thrown into conversations, being completely oblivious of those things being done by the white academic. And that's mainly, I think, an issue in conferences where you don't really know people, and academia is very much what do you do, what do you work on, and that defines you. But for scholars of colour, your colour defines you beforehand, and what you do is defined by your colour or assumed by your colour.
So I tend to find that the wide lens tends to be most in focus at seminars or conferences or forum settings in general, which, given the nature of the field at the moment, can be dominated sometimes by white voices. And in particular, I think when the white lens is focused on what we might call classical ways of approaching Shakespeare, whiteness seems to be attached to an oblivion or even a blissful ignorance of kind, particularly of the kinds of access that students and audiences might have had to particular resources and styles of training. So I've seen and experienced situations where whiteness allows a speaker to assume a certain level of knowledge or a certain grasp of language and theory or a certain network of relationships which are just not part of a reality for so many students, and students who are interested in Shakespeare from underprivileged backgrounds or just students who haven't had access in a historical relationship to this training. And this might include second language English speakers, many of whom tend to be black or minority ethnic students, and sometimes students who are first in their family attend university and they don't have these long-standing relationships with academic Shakespeare and the higher education setting. On the other hand, I think the effect of the white lens more recently has become most obvious in conversations where race and colonization have been put at the center of the discussion. And again, these rooms tend to be dominated by white voices, at least in the experiences that I've had. And I often find myself to be maybe one of two or three people of color in these rooms, in these spaces, if not the only person. And you very quickly become aware of this, of the fact that you're non-white. And in one recent event that I attended that was meant to be about decolonial pedagogy, a lot of the conversation ended up being about the discomfort and anxieties of being white and trying to teach Shakespeare and race to students, where actually the conversations they should have been having or things that I was interested to learn would have been related to strategies people are using to teach early modern race and how they're approaching having to teach students to unlearn concepts. And in these conversations, it was really obvious how the white lens constricts understandings of the broader decolonial agenda, and particularly its relationship to power and hierarchy. Because decolonizing Shakespeare is not just about being apologetic and preferring Othello over Hamlet. It's also about interrogating the structures of higher education institutions that especially perpetuate inequality and imbalances of power, as well as recognizing the varied socioeconomic and racial, cultural, and gender subjectivities of students, and how best not only to consider these, but also to emphasize these realities moving forward in order to decolonize Shakespeare, and also to use Shakespeare as a decolonizing tool. Self-awareness is, of course, an important part of this process, but it isn't the process itself. And although words of support are important, commitment to decolonizing Shakespeare needs to manifest in actions.
Can you give us an example of what it might be like to read Shakespeare for the first time without the framework of whiteness? It's freedom. It is the freedom to read, write, rewrite, edit, excise, perform, appropriate, and adapt Shakespeare. Ayanna Thompson calls it destabilizing Shakespeare in her book Passing Strange. Kim Hall, in her introduction to Keith Hamilton Cobb's American War, writes, quote, "Black love of Shakespeare is a site of profound struggle, and Othello its most vexed object," unquote. "I wish to return to an unvexed, uncomplicated love I once had for Shakespeare when I read him for the first time in high school. I was 14 years old. But the price of change is pain, and the struggle remains profound."
I think one important way to read and recognize Shakespeare outside of a frame of whiteness is to explore translations of his material. So by this I mean both language translations, where the English has been translated into another language, as well as cultural translations, which we often see through performances and adaptations that move Shakespeare's plays to non-Western, non-European, non-white contexts and histories. I think we need to draw from these strategies of drama to inform the way we read Shakespeare in his textual form. I recently heard South African actor John Carney reflect on his experiences as a young man reading a translation of Julius Caesar in isiXhosa, which is one of the official languages of South Africa. And he basically describes how powerfully this translated version of the text resonated with him because of the energy of the language. And he relates how, by comparison, he found Shakespeare to be really underwhelming. Carney, of course, has a special affinity to Shakespeare's plays, and he's known to speak about their ability to bring people together. I think it indicates the way that connections to Shakespeare can become much stronger when people are presented with channels for connection and identification. This creates real promise for the decolonization of Shakespeare. Some other examples of translation that come to mind are Suleiman al-Bassam's The Al-Hamlet Summit, which repurposes Shakespeare's Hamlet to explore ideas of religious and political extremism in the Arab world. And so maybe a comparative study of al-Bassam's texts and Shakespeare's original could be very meaningful to think about how the universally recognized ideas from Shakespeare's Hamlet are translated into the new performance in a way that allows a different culture to lay some claim to these powerful literary tropes. Similarly, a text like Aimé Césaire's Un Tempest, which sets or repurposes Shakespeare's The Tempest for a setting of colonized Caribbean, and this text is a really useful companion to read alongside the original, especially because of how Caliban's subjectivity is rewritten by Césaire to empower him. These adaptations are really strong starting points for thinking about how to read Shakespeare without a white lens, primarily because they remind us that it's not ever really possible to deny other people's ownerships of texts. So you can dictate the narratives of a text and even erase some of their features, as the white lens sometimes tends to do, but you can never lay total claim to it. There's always going to be room to challenge those claims, and that's what I think translation, cultural and literary and linguistic, sort of allows to happen.
To read Shakespeare without the framework of whiteness, I think, and maybe I'm wrong, would be to read Shakespeare as a white person, right? A white person who doesn't see colour, because again, whiteness is not normally seen as a colour, or a race is seen as sort of the norm, the invisible. In the same sense of saying we don't see colour, which effectively erases the experiences of people of colour, I think in turn, if we are treating whiteness as a colour, I don't think you want to read or teach Shakespeare without acknowledging its whiteness. I'm quite sort of conflicted about this question, because I think at one point I was thinking, oh, well, wouldn't it be great if we could read Shakespeare without the framework of whiteness, where, you know, every culture and every race was represented. However, that would be erasing a history of whiteness that I think we do have to acknowledge. I think what it comes down to is, if we make whiteness visible in Shakespeare's play, and instead of focusing on anti-blackness, what if we consider Shakespeare's characters from a critical lens of anti-whiteness, and what might that look like? But I'm quite conflicted about this question, because the other way I was thinking is, if we're embracing every race and culture, I think there's something in Shakespeare's works that, because one of the questions I've been thinking about is, why on earth are so many different cultures and ethnicities still adapting this white old man? And I think one of the answers to that is that Shakespeare does speak to different cultures, and it can be appropriated with the right people working on it. I think that the power of adaptations, of appropriations, of translations, that might be something of reading Shakespeare without the framework of whiteness.
So I'm here with Dr. Ruben Espinoza of the University of Texas, El Paso. Thank you so much, Ruben, for your time and for being here with us today.
Thank you for inviting me, Farah. It's a treat to chat with you, for sure. So thanks so much.
In this episode, we're talking about the whiteness of Shakespeare. So I'm going to start by asking you to tell us about your particular journey to Shakespeare and race studies.
So it's twofold, right? I guess, you know, my journey into Shakespeare was, like most people, through high school engagement with Shakespeare. At some point in high school, I took a drama class and was prompted to join the drama club. In the process, I remember they announced they were going to be staging Midsummer Night's Dream, and Dead Poets Society had just come out. I was a big fan of it. It strangely felt like an affinity to that movie. And, you know, Neil, obviously, in that movie, auditions for the role of Puck. Thinking back on that, to think about some of these brown kids on the border, right, engaging with Shakespeare, my affinity for that through a movie that centers whiteness, it's, you know, all these white boys in a prep school, right? It could not be more different experiences for us, right? It's only now that I think back on that, that's like, wow, my entry into Shakespeare. You know, after grad school, I cut my teeth on a book on new historicism, and it felt comfortable, and the work there was okay. I felt like my work on Shakespeare and immigration, finally things started to matter to me, and I could just pivot to, you know, contemporary views of Shakespeare, and that's been it since. And you know, in terms of race studies, I felt for the first time my work as meaningful. I remember when my first book came out, I imagined in my mind seeing it at the SAA book display how important and significant that would be, and it was so anticlimactic. I remember standing there looking around that room and thinking, like, who am I writing for, you know? And so I went into a bit of a funk. Thankfully, through race studies came out of it. So that's been, you know, my journey into that.
That's a really amazing story, because so many of us scholars of color, we swallow this pill of Shakespeare where we sort of go, oh God, I want that. I want to do that. I want to preach on that mountain as well, you know. And when you get to that mountain, if you get to that mountain, if you get to the top of that mountain, you realize about all the gatekeeping all the way up, and you actually think, wow, this mountain wasn't built for me.
It's wonderfully stated, and I could not agree with that more. I mean, it did feel, I mean, for a long time, you know, I think about the SAA and feeling like so uncomfortable and so, you know, just kind of.
And that's the Shakespeare Association of America you're referring to, which is a big scholarly organization with something like 2,500 or 3,000 Shakespeare scholars as members.
I didn't feel comfortable in my skin there. And, you know, I used that phrase deliberately. I really felt like I did not belong. Once I found my community, then, you know, a different level of confidence and purpose emerged. But I think that's right. And it's challenging those perceptions. I think that's so important for us.
I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the context in which you're teaching Shakespeare. You know, when I've heard you give talks and when you've spoken about the work that you do with your students, it's so fascinating. So I wonder if you could sort of talk a little bit about that.
Of course. I feel like if you haven't been to El Paso, it's hard to imagine a place like this. It's a border city, right? And I think people have perceptions of border cities in the U.S. But it is truly one that melds with Juarez, Ciudad Juarez in Mexico. I mean, if you cross the bridge in downtown El Paso, you know, literally step into downtown Juarez. And so it's very, very fluid in terms of that. Obviously now the border is closed for the most part here, right? And makes that difficult. But in terms of thinking about borderland experiences, that is the unique nature of what my students see, what they experience, how they come to everything that they do. And obviously Shakespeare, so binational, bicultural, bilingual identities, right? The fraught nature surrounding all of that. Gloria Anzaldúa, you know, who talks about it, is feeling like you're in two places at once and not quite belonging in each. And so I try to bring those ideas to bear in my teaching and have my students really consider their as they come to the work itself. It becomes both a complex and I think a very, very enriching in strange ways experience for them. You know, the border crisis added a layer where students felt energy and desire to engage with the community because it was horrific. A lot of our students are Mexican nationals who actually live in Juarez and who cross over daily to come to school. For a period of time below the U.S.-Mexico bridge, they were housing is the wrong term, they were caging immigrants and keeping them in these makeshift camps, you know, with tents underneath that bridge. And so if students were crossing over, I mean, this is something they would see on a daily basis. And then not to mention, you know, the horrific past 10 years of cartel violence in Juarez. These kind of emotional, psychological tolls on them, you know, are important. And I don't want to look away from them. This is a topic that I think we need to be discussing in our classrooms. And so that's where my emphasis is. I try to create a space where students feel comfortable talking about, you know, what this border means and how it is. And it's only become more complex since then, you know, with Patrick Crucius, the white terrorist who drove from Dallas, Texas to El Paso to, you know, in his words, kill as many Mexicans as he could. It opens an opportunity to think about what rhetoric is out there that led him to do this, you know, both at our state leadership level. Greg Abbott had sent out a memo prior to that saying that we need to defend the border. Of course, we know that, you know, the person at the very top of our own government here, right, has denigrated Mexicans to no end. And so, you know, those feelings, I think, of kind of a precarious existence within their nation or the nation in which they are attending school here, right, are important topics for us to consider. And so, you know, getting students to really think about that, and something that I think often they're not willing or wanting to think about, has been both a challenge, but also, I think, a hallmark of the classes that I teach.
I wish I was in your class.
No.
I mean, how do they respond to Shakespeare in that context then? What is their reaction to his work and to, you know, the white Shakespeare?
Paul Gilroy here, right, the dislocating dazzle of whiteness is certainly in place whenever they approach Shakespeare. And I often ask them, you know, I say Shakespeare and you think what? Often what is the driving force for them is thinking like his universality, right? He speaks across history, across time, right, but also across cultures. And you know, when I ask how, that becomes a stifling question here, right? And really it is an opportunity at the very start to dismantle those perceptions here, right? That still is difficult, and I can't pretend that, you know, at the end of every semester, you know, all students get it. There's a lot of pushback, a lot of resistance, a lot of students feeling like, that's not the Shakespeare that I want to study. I came here to learn why he's the bard, right? I came here to experience some kind of universal truth. And it is a matter of saying, look, if it's not meaningful to you, then it's not meaningful. And you've got to really think about that. If you don't see yourself in the literary work, what is the point? Thankfully, I have so many, you know, scholars to draw from. I mean, I was in a recent conversation where critical race studies of Shakespeare was being described as an emergent field, right? And I will blame myself for not speaking up, but thankfully a colleague of mine, you know, very casually said, like, I've made the same mistake too in calling it an emergent field, but we have to recognize it's not an emergent field. It's been around for a long time. And so there's a lot out there for students to read, and they, I guarantee they have not thought about Shakespeare in that way. And when they do, it's just this kind of moment of awakening. And I love to see that. You know, one recently told me about Vanessa's work, Vanessa Cordera. She said, you know, I want to grow up to write like her, right? And to be her. And it's such a wonderful thing to behold. Yeah.
I want to ask you about how the whiteness of Shakespeare and Shakespeare studies might pose a problem for students of color, especially students who want to move into the field at a postgraduate level. I wonder if you can unpack for me what that whiteness is and the challenges of it.
For sure. I think that there's a reluctance to question whiteness, in general whiteness, but also Shakespeare's whiteness, and specifically the structures that elevate whiteness over everything else here, right, for our students. And so as a result, that whiteness becomes somewhat invisible, right, and taken for granted. And so these are the structures that I think I invite students to think about. And it's not very difficult. I mean, if we're reading Kim F. Hall early on, you know, they begin to see already how the works are perpetuating, you know, perceptions of white supremacy. And when they hear something like white supremacy, then suddenly it has teeth, right? Suddenly it has meaning for them, and they begin to think about that. And we can't pretend that Shakespeare isn't, for many, just this monument to whiteness. And so I think scrutinizing that monument, dismantling that monument, toppling that monument in this moment is critical, but also giving students a sense of ownership over that, and to make them recognize that Shakespeare's longevity is because through generations, people have made Shakespeare into what they feel, you know, he should be. And why not you? That has been, I think, a way in to think about Shakespeare. We show popular films, they're going to see Shakespeare as white, right? Baz Luhrmann's film, I think, is a great example. You know, you have Mercutio on some level where you play with language and you think about, you know, Dost thou make minstrels of us here, right? And how that matters if it's a black man saying that those lines. And on the one hand, you know, these are great opportunities, but on the other, then you have the, you know, portrayal of Latinxes, you have the whitewashing of Hollywood in plays where many Latinxes were played by white actors. And so, you know, students aren't necessarily thinking about that. And once that's brought to their attention, then they begin to see, wow, these are pretty big structures, right? And Shakespeare has both helped to create those structures, right, but have an opportunity to question them, right?
And, you know, the Globe's been guilty of doing that as well, that, you know, presenting a culture as opposed to being inclusive.
Yeah, to be certain, I mean, there's a lot of criticism that can be doled out. And it's a moment, Vera, and I know you know this. I mean, it's a moment now where people are reckoning with, specifically here in the U.S., right, with a kind of racist, violent history that has defined people here for so long.
Your work on social justice, I know that is really, really important to you. And where I quote you is when you talk about, do we need Shakespeare? No, Shakespeare needs us. And that was a really powerful thing that you said. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you mean by social justice.
You know, in terms of social justice and what I mean by that and where at least my efforts are, I absolutely think that this is the only way to make Shakespeare relevant for students and to really make it relevant specifically for students in this particular region. If you can't come out of a class feeling like you have as much access and legitimate understanding of Shakespeare as anybody else here, right, then it's not useful. And the reason for that is not just a sense of like, okay, well, I get Shakespeare, right, but rather instilling a sense of confidence in our students that they might not otherwise have. And I point to the case in, you know, Tucson, Arizona, right, where high school students who were taking a Mexican American studies class, these students stood up to a Republican aide for the then superintendent of the school district, Dolores Huerta, who was a civil rights activist. She had gone to speak to the students saying, you know, you need to wake up, you're becoming voters, you need to be, you know, responsible. And she's like, and it's time to recognize that Republicans hate Latinos. I'm quoting her directly. And it was a moment. I mean, it was a moment where these students felt like, you know, yeah, she was right. When the superintendent heard of this, he sent his own aide to say that, you know, Republicans didn't hate Latinos, right? To kind of correct that. And the students, instead of listening, they all turned their back on the speaker and they raised their fists, you know, in this kind of poetic throwback to Tommy Smith, right? It's a great moment, but the result of that was that the superintendent found that it was his obligation to dismantle the Mexican American Studies program. The reason Shakespeare's involved in that is because the Tempest was part of that teaching. The teachers had to, under penalty of law and ridiculous fines, like upwards of six figures, if they broached the topic of race or colonialism, then they could be found guilty of this. And so they had to identify all the books that might lead to these conversations, right? And The Tempest was one of them. And so Shakespeare was implicated in this. The long and short of it is that, you know, a year later, after this program was dismantled, a study from the University of Arizona found that students who were in this Mexican American Studies program had higher graduation rates, higher college enrollment. The measures of success were greater for them. And so by dismantling this was stifling, right, that growth. And so it's no secret. And having a kind of strong sense of self, confidence in one's ethnic cultural identity will give one that ability to move forward in these ways. It's an opportunity for me. Every English major has to take a Shakespeare course. If it's with me, we're going to talk about these particular issues.
You know, something you've said really highlights the importance of how we teach Shakespeare. Because of that structure of whiteness, Shakespeare is on the curriculum and has to be taught. Everybody has to take a Shakespeare course. And so the responsibility as the person delivering that is great.
Yeah, absolutely. That's often, you know, day one to ask them to recognize. Like, you do know that this is the only sole authored class that you are required to take here, right? Suddenly they're like, yes, but because it's Shakespeare, right? Like, let's question that, right? Yeah.
Yes. So what we've been doing in these podcasts is asking all of our participants one question, which I'm just going to throw at you. You know, we're thinking about decolonizing Shakespeare, and at the Globe, we're really trying to sort of meditate on what that means. And I wonder if you could tell me what that means from your perspective. What does it mean to decolonize Shakespeare?
For me, it goes back, I might sound like a broken record here, right? But people of color, certainly people, black and brown individuals, feeling a sense of ownership over Shakespeare, that he is part of their legacy. And so for me, here on the border, we often talk about this in terms of linguistic identity, and it's such a fraught issue here. So often people say we should be studying Cervantes here on the border, right, instead of Shakespeare. And it's a quick fix, right? I mean, it's an idea that somehow students will identify with a Spanish author. Odds are, if they're going to be reading Cervantes, it's going to be in translation. Not to mention, you know, he's also the colonizer. I mean, you're thinking about, you know, the entities from which they both arrived. And so the process of decolonization is really reckoning with the fact that these languages, this literary heritage that comes from both sides, has been in many ways mobilized, deployed to render our students in the present moment as lesser than here, right? If they do feel that not only do they have access to Shakespeare, but legitimate views of Shakespeare that have something meaningful to offer, then that's half the battle. That's understanding the oppressive structures that have defined them and turning that and thinking about Shakespeare in a different way. And that in and of itself here, I think, creates hopefully opportunities for the students to see that this stems way beyond Shakespeare here, right, into their everyday lived experiences. That, for me, to decenter Shakespeare from this kind of white academy, to decenter Shakespeare from, you know, what we've been told Shakespeare is, to question the gatekeeping of Shakespeare too, then allows for us to think about all the ways that gatekeeping works. And they arrive at these conclusions by themselves, which is as good as it gets.
Thank you so much. It was so brilliant to have you on here and to welcome you back to the Globe.
Yeah, thank you, Farah, for having me.
That's it from us, but we'll be back next week with another episode in our Shakespeare and Race series. We'll be taking a closer look at our education system, from school through university and also, in particular, at drama schools. You've been listening to Such Stuff with me, Imogen Greenberg, and Professor Farah Karim Cooper. To find out more about Shakespeare's Globe, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'll be back soon with more stories from Shakespeare's Globe, so subscribe wherever you get this podcast from.